This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman in this morning for Catherine Cruz. Each day, there seem to be new developments in the continuing story of Mauna Kea, the planned construction of the 30-meter telescope, and the protests against it. We continue to hear from a wide number of voices on the topic, and this morning we wanted to bring you some thoughts from University of Hawaii President David Lassner. This past Sunday, Lassner went to Mauna Kea and spent about an hour there. He met with protesters and said he wanted to witness for myself firsthand what is happening here. 2 days ago, he posted a message on the university website about Mauna Kea, saying in part, quote, "I realize that TMT now represents a huge source of friction in our work to become a model indigenous-serving university and a Hawaiian place of learning. We will need many conversations over the months ahead to work on that together. My heart and mind are open as I continue to listen and share. Let me close with my biggest concern. We need to keep the fabric of our university from being torn apart." Lassner says he has no plans to resign. Last week, he was part of a panel on the theme of leadership as part of a conference put together by Hawaii Business Magazine. I moderated that panel and asked him about the challenges of leading a diverse university community in the context of the divisive issue of Mauna Kea.
Mauna Kea is certainly the biggest issue I've faced in my career. I think for many people who are involved, it might be the biggest issue Hawaii is facing in maybe a couple of decades even. And UH is smack in the middle of it, and I'm smack in the middle of it. And it's a history that goes back with UH over 50 years. So there's a lot of history that I have inherited and some history that I own. So as I navigate this, it's really both personal and it's professional. This is not something where we as a community will get consensus. We are divided across almost every dimension, and I will say inside the university, we are even more divided than what you see in the community. So I have the challenge of being the leader for an institution that has taken a position over decades with people everywhere on both sides of the issue. So it's easy to demonize. It's easy if you view the world as black and white. And I have many people inside our community and certainly many people around the state who thinks that this is easy if they could just convince everyone to their perspective. But the perspectives are incredibly deep-seated and go back generations for many people who have strong views. This is not 140 characters, but I did want to talk about what it means to be a leader, and I think for me, I need to make every part of my community feel valued, that their opinions matter, even though not everyone's going to get their way. And for me, part of that is listening and telling people I'm listening. It doesn't mean I will do what you say, but I'm listening. I need people to listen to each other respectfully and appreciate each other's opinions, even when they aren't articulated particularly well. And ultimately, I need people to trust me that even if they disagree with me on this one, and it's a big one, they are still have confidence in me as a leader, because we are much more than this single issue.
University of Hawaii President David Lassner talking about Mauna Kea. That took place last week at a panel on leadership at a conference put together by Hawaii Business Magazine. As I mentioned earlier, I moderated that panel and asked a follow-up question about communication. Framing this in a leadership sense, communication, like management now, there's no longer a sense of controlling the narrative. It has become a matter of influencing, perhaps. That's a much tougher prospect. So as a leader, how do you influence the narrative of your own story, knowing that you can't control it?
Wow. I'll just say a couple of things. One is in telling your story, and again, in this particular situation, I can't tell my personal story at the expense of the stories of other people I care about deeply who are not at the same place I am on this story. So that limits me from using the tactics of black and white that are so prevalent in particularly social media today. I think the influence of social media on complex issues, the bubble effect that I think we all know about from the 2016 election in particular, where people see and are reinforced among people that they largely agree with, in short narratives, cherry-picked narratives. And if you don't want to do that, because my goal isn't, I mean, my communications guys, it drives them crazy because I won't engage in that. And frankly, the people who are with me, I say things to them that they don't want to hear either. But that's part of, for me, trying to lead with integrity through a hard situation. Yesterday I saw an article, I think it was from BuzzFeed, and it was about the guy who invented the retweet button. And he basically said, I'm going to paraphrase because I don't remember exactly, he said, I have put nuclear armaments in the hands of four-year-olds. And that is unfortunately what's shaping our narrative today. You know, how will we as a community support actual journalism that tries to tell stories fairly? And there's a lot less of that than there used to be.
University of Hawaii President David Lasner speaking last week at a panel on leadership at a conference put together by Hawaii Business Magazine. Our thanks to our partners and colleagues at Hawaii Business Magazine for the panel itself and for the ability to share the audio with you this morning. As I mentioned earlier in the program, we continue to bring you a number of voices and perspectives on Mauna Kea. We will continue to provide a forum for diverse voices and viewpoints on this topic and others. If you'd like to share your thoughts on this topic or on any other, you can call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or you can send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, offering catering options including entrees, sides, garden bar, and more. Information at rubytuesdayhawaii.com or 838-9001.
One ocean, one people, one canoe. HPR invites you to a screening of Moana Nui a Kea, the documentary of Hokulea's landmark worldwide voyage, and a Q&A with Hokulea crew members. Sunday, August 18th in Waimea on Hawaii Island, Sunday, August 25th in Honolulu, and Saturday, August 31st in Lihue. Reserve your spot at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Dawson.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's backyard quiz, we explore the legacy of trailblazing baseball star Wally Yonamine. Born during Hawaii's territorial days to Matsusai and Kikui Yonamine in 1925, he actually played a season of professional football before his baseball career took off. In one season for the San Francisco 49ers, he had 19 carries and 3 passes for about 100 yards total and was the first Japanese-American to play pro football. Walter Achu was the first Asian-American professional football player, but that's another backyard quiz entirely. In 1951, Yonemine joined the Yomiuri Giants, the Kyojin for Tokyo natives and fans. He played there for 9 seasons before joining the Chunichi Dragons in 1960. He played on the Dragons for another 2 seasons before retiring and eventually became the team's manager in the mid-1970s. He was inducted into the Japanese Baseball Hall of Fame in 1994 for his achievements, and to this day, he is the only American player admitted to its ranks. Wally Yonemine remains one of Hawaii's most distinguished homegrown athletes. And for today's Backyard Quiz, we're asking you to name the sparsely populated community where this baseball legend was born. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Hi, I'm Annie Camilla from the band Mango Season. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HPR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
You may have spent some time lately watching or listening to the Democratic political debates, or at least to the news coverage about them, and maybe that's got you wondering about political polls. How useful are they, and what can we really learn from them? Our contributing editor, Neil Milner, is here with some thoughts about how to read those polls like a pro. Help us out, Neil.
Okay, I'll help you out. Well, let's start with the polls that you're starting to see right now, particularly about the Democratic candidates and who people approve and at what percentage. The ones that are effective may be the surprising ones, and the ones that's not effective that you don't have to pay attention to, you might think would be the least surprising one. The ones that turn out to be a fairly good predictor are the polls that just simply say what percentage of the people support these particular candidates. And over time, over a series of primaries starting back in the 70s, the studies show that they're not bad predictors of who will ultimately get the nomination. If 6 months before the 6 months before you get nominated, the nominating conventions, you have 35% support or more, 75% of those people get the nomination for presidency. In other words, if you're going along at 35%, it's pretty likely that you'll get the nomination. Twice as likely as the next category down. Now,
and that's 6 months ahead. So that's
6 months ahead.
January, so, February next.
Well,
year,
that's right. So we got two limitations right now. One limitation, of course, is that it's not 6 months ahead, and so the polls show that nobody right now is at 35. Joe Biden tends to be around the low 30s and stable, but it gives you an idea of what to watch for. You always have to remember one of the caveats here is that people's preferences in primaries are very fluid because they don't know the candidates very well, and because the main cue that people look for, what party is that person in, that doesn't work here because they're all Democrats or they're all Republicans. So, but even so, you get some usefulness of following the polls. The ones that don't, that are really inaccurate, are these polls that are done 6 months to a year before, these hypothetical polls between the likely Republican nominee and the likely Democrat nominee. So if you did a poll a year from now and it was Trump versus, I don't know, you pick your own candidate, they tend not to be very accurate. So in terms of the polls generally right now, what you can pay attention to and what you should sort of pass off, I'm talking a little bit of the future, but those seem to be the things.
Interesting. Also, the nature of polling itself, I mean, just so many questions and variations about that. But part of this also of the idea of questions that are asked in a similar phrasing over a period of time, and those being of more use than other types of polls.
Yeah, I mean, there are two rules of thumb to remember here. This is without looking at polling methodology in any kind of complicated way. The more you have a measure over time of the same question, the more useful the poll is. And the more polls you look at, the more useful the poll is. For example, 538.com does a composite of Trump approval and disapproval ratings. So they're taking about, I don't know, what, 20 polls, regularly looking at them, and they average out. And that tends to be a more reliable way of looking at things. Also, as I say, looking at trends, particularly about issues, not so much about candidates, polls are pretty good. It's a trend analysis. It goes over time. The one thing to add to this is that if you're looking at a particular issue and you want to look at some polls, the best thing to do is to look at how that polling organization, that specific polling organization, has dealt with it over time, because polls differ in terms of their methodological biases, in terms of how they ask the question. It's called the house effect. And we understand what some of these house effects are. And except for bogus polls, they're not purposely Democratic or Republican. So if you want to follow, I don't know, if you want to follow Harris polling or YouGov or anything else like that, the best thing to follow an issue, look at how that issue is over time. And the other thing to do is, there is almost no watersheds in politics. That is, a poll may show something that's a big jump, and it's probably just temporary. It's probably just an outlier. That's a hard one, because the media has a here and now push toward change kind of emphasis. That's not ideological. It's just, you're reporting the day's news. You tend to emphasize what happens that day. But for the most part, these are kind of gradual slogs.
But that idea of sort of reaching for the headline, or saying, "Oh my gosh, the polls have changed, the polls have shifted," that's number one, a temptation. But it's also, as you say, in terms of the context of other polling information over time, and sets of polls taken together
right,
are an important measure to look at.
That's right. That's why it mitigates some of this. If you I mean, here's a good example right now. We always look at the bounce that people get after, let's say, they're nominated for president, or after a particular debate. And there often is a bounce. But the bounce typically doesn't last, because lots of things happen. More debates, the world changes, there are other candidates that come in. And one of the ways to deal with that is to always be skeptical about any kind of big change. That doesn't mean it's not likely. That doesn't mean it isn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's not likely. So whoever gets the bounce out of the last two debates, it's something that will probably flatten out.
And the integrity of different kinds of polls, I mean, there's a lot more than there used to be in terms of opt-in, tell us what you think, or, you know, cast your ballot in support of this or that. But that's in terms of scientific usefulness. Those are not really particularly helpful.
I think there's two issues here. One is, let's call it methodological, and the other is called political. The methodological things that you should pay attention to is that some polling, there are different ways of polling, and the differences are not necessarily showing illegitimacy on some side. But as 538.com says, there's a certain gold standard that you look for. One thing is that the polls are done by real people over the phone, as opposed to robocalls.
Oh, yes.
The second thing is that landlines and cell phones are included in it, and that's begun to happen. The third, and this is trickier, is that there's a kind of transparency that the public polling organizations, professional organizations, have standards of transparency. One of the standards is show your data, show how you got that kind of stuff. That's the issue there that you can pay attention to. And people ought to pay attention to that. And the data is generally available in a poll. The political stuff, of course, and there are different ways of polling that are not bad, that are not necessarily the gold standard. The opt-in poll, where essentially you volunteer to be polled and they have models that they can use to make it representative, that's getting into the weeds. But they definitely aren't there. The political thing, of course, is that people do all kinds of BS with polls, including, of course, the candidates.
Sure.
And so My rule of thumb is anything a candidate says about his or her poll that you can't actually see on paper and see how it was done, I don't pay any attention to it, and I would advise people not to. But, you know, there are push polls. There are polls that are used to ask loaded questions, and you just have to be very careful and skeptical. If you're participating in a poll and you find the questions a little weird, you probably don't want to pay attention to it. The hard thing is confirmation bias. If these questions, if these suspicions, you're less likely to be suspicious of people who tend to say things that you want to be, you want to say. And that's a whole nother dimension here.
Interesting. Watch for confirmation bias as always, and look, as always, for transparency.
Yes, for sure.
All right.
Neil Including Miller. In yourself.
Yes, starting with that always. Yes. Political analyst, social scientist Neil Milner, contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View. Thanks, Neil.
Sure.
Honolulu's rail project continues to move forward, but there's another legal showdown on the way. This one has to do with property acquisitions and a major player in Honolulu's urban development. Honolulu Civil Beat's Marcel Honoré has been following this story and joins us with more this morning. And Marcel, this is a dispute between the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation and the Howard Hughes Corporation. Set the stage a bit for us.
Yeah. Hey, Bill. So this is probably one of the more high profile disputes among various property acquisition disputes that have hit HART. The difference is it's Howard Hughes Corporation. And so a lot of the landowners along the line, you know, when they've gotten prices and offers that they haven't liked, the way it's generally kind of played out is, well, they don't really like the offer. They feel it's undervalued. But as far as them being small business owners, small landowners, you know, it's tough. They have to weigh, well, then I have to hire an attorney and all the time and effort involved. And maybe you break even. It hasn't always balanced out for some of these landowners to proceed and really battle HART and the city over condemnation. But the difference here is now you're looking at a large, you know, landowner, one of the more prominent and powerful developers in Kaka'ako, and they certainly have a dispute with HART over key parcels that the city is going to need if it's going to get rail all the way to Ala Moana.
And just the scale on this, again, for listeners who may not have been paying close attention to this, is pretty stunning. So basically, Howard Hughes says that they have a value that's about $100 million more than the city's latest offer, and HART's total budget to acquire more than 200 properties along the whole rail line is $193 million.
Yeah, that's right. And that really kind of puts us in perspective. You know, I wish I had like the base figures to give you, but all I can say for sure is that at some point in these negotiations, and this is all laid out in one of the more recent federal oversight reports, that these two parties were $100 million apart in terms of valuation. And yeah, the whole budget for property acquisition along the full 20-mile line from the fields east of Kapolei to Ala Moana, that whole budget to get all those properties is $193 million. So it really shows that, you know, they're really far apart, and they're really far apart with some big players. And, you know, the negotiations have broken down. That's not to say that these parties can always settle. You know, a lot of times what you'll see is that these things get resolved on the courthouse steps, so to speak. So we don't know what's going to happen, but it really is kind of a rock and a hard place. And it's heading towards a trial over eminent domain that if they can't come to some sort of agreement, should occur next year.
And that idea about sort of the discussion of this as it goes into legal proceedings and even the negotiations ahead of that, I mean, What goes into sort of the determination of what is a fair price in terms of valuation of that? Because, again, that's such a wild difference in terms of valuation.
Right. I think the best way I can answer it as somebody who's I'm not an appraiser myself.
Sure.
But one of the differences that they've butted heads with, and in the limited discussion I've managed to hear in public meetings with Howard Hughes, and it kind of reflects what you've heard in other situations along the line, is the appraisals are really looking at, you know, the straight up land value. And what a lot of the owners have been contesting is that, you know, these are partial takes. It's not that they're looking to take the whole parcel. They're looking to just take the strips and the slices that they need along the rail line and not take the whole property. But what Howard Hughes and others have said is like that these particular spots that you're taking are going to be particularly detrimental to our business. And, you know, it's parking spots, it's driveways, it's ingress, egress for vehicles to be able to get onto the property. And that's not reflected in the offer prices that we're getting. That's generally a lot of the complaints that have surfaced in the property acquisition. And you've heard that, you know, it's hard to say exactly what the issues are at the heart of this, but you have heard that in these discussions with Howard Hughes.
And it's interesting just in terms of the extent of the proceedings themselves. As you point out, Howard Hughes, very large corporation, this may go on for some time.
Right. Well, it's just kind of a wait and see. You know, this has been flying a little under the radar, and I just kind of wanted to write about it to, you know, just show people that it is in fact happening, even if we're not privy to it.
Absolutely. Appreciate that. Marcel Honoré. Thanks, Marcel.
Sure thing. Thanks, Bill.
Marcel Honoré covering rail, very detailed and over time with today's reality check from our partners at Civil Beat. You can read his full story today at civilbeat.org.
Every time I'm in the car, I will put it on HBR. And especially on I travel from Hilo to Kona, I will midway switch it to the Kona HBR just so I can listen to it all the way over.
Member supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
It's been about 3 weeks since fire swept through a part of central Maui, burning through more than 9,000 acres. The initial fires started on former sugarcane fields. Dry conditions combined with high winds pushed them across roads, even forced some flights to be diverted from Kahului Airport. Fires are part of the environment in which we live, but as with so much else, they are being affected by climate change. And they're a growing problem in many parts of the Pacific. HPR's Noe Tanigao has been looking into this and joins us with more.
Right, Bill. It was so fascinating to meet Clay Trowernick. He's a wildland fire specialist, and he's been looking at this huge data set that we've got of fire records. It goes back all the way to 1904.
Wow.
So we've got a set to look at here, and what it shows is that we've had this 400% increase in acres burned just in the past several decades here. And he says that fires affect Hawaii way differently than they do in other places.
One of these impacts that distinguishes fires in Hawaii from the rest of the mainland is the fact that once you get an area that's burned, it's just opened up this erosion problem now. All of these fallow lands that we're no longer using, you get these big fires, they burn out all of that grassland and shrubland, they kind of erode the edges of our watershed forest. That grassland expands over the long term and you lose forest cover, but in the short term, all of that soil is now completely exposed to rainfall and you get these big sediment loads being carried out to the reef.
So that Maui fire you were talking about is the perfect example here. I mean, Trawernick says there used to be an average about 5,000 acres a year burning all the way through the early 1900s. There was a spike in the 1960s. Then, 1970s through 90s, there was a huge jump. So these days, we see 20,000 acres burned annually across this state. I mean, they thought, oh, yeah, it must be climate change. But the biggest correlation that he and other scientists have found after studying this is the changes that we've had in land use, the demise of plantation farming and ranching. And that's leaving huge tracts of land basically untended, kind of, right?
Well, that's, I was going to say, when you did the 70s to the 90s thing, that was a sharp decline in terms of plantations. And the water that goes with them, the use of water, as well, along as part of the picture.
It certainly is. And now firefighters are fighting fires in this land that they were used to really not be responsible for, where fires were not as common, and also where it's harder to get to water these days. So complications are multiplying. And, you know, people look at fires and our history of fires, and a lot of them they can't tell why they were caused. But of the 800 in history, they've pinpointed the causes for 98% were actually started by people, and 75% of those were accidental. This sounds nuts, but it's actually kind of good news, according to Trawernick, because that tells us that we can stop this if we just think a little bit more closely about our careless matches, about our barbecues, the campfires, even stuff like leaving your car running in tall grass. I mean, you know, stuff like that. I mean, we remember it was just a spark from an axe that started that Mendocino fire, you know, last year. Well, it depends on conditions being ripe for a fire to happen. And that has a lot to do with humidity and fuels. There's, you know, we've got the fuels out there now, of course, and there is a sweet spot for where these fires happen on the landscape. Trawernick says all those old sugar pineapple ranch lands are just about perfect because the shrubs, the grasses come in, African grasses move in, and once they're burned, they love fire. They come right back on in. Their roots stay fine underground. The tops burn off, and then they sprout again, and they're ready for another fire, really. And that was a perfect example there in central Maui. Now, here in Honolulu County, Trawernick says we've got an astronomical number of fires, 500 to 600 ignitions a year. He can't find another city that's got that kind of frequency. Not house fires, but we're talking about little fires in vacant lots and all of that. And he says it's not going to get any better with climate change because that's pointing to drying trends all across Hawaii. Our fire risk in Hawaii is just kind of year-round, and it's driven by green-up events, as it is elsewhere in the Pacific where you have
green
these...
Green-up events.
Green-up, yeah, like in Australia where you just have water, rain come down, the grasses green up. Then you have a drought or drying, and then turns brown and it burns, and then you have the green up again. And so that is kind of, our fire risk is year-round, just like that. Why don't we have the same kind of scary fires like they have in California? Because we don't have the topography or the land mass for it, according to Trawernick. He also says we don't have that humidity down into the teens. This is where he thinks we're going to have trouble in the future because the forecast for climate change is that we're going to be facing more drying trends. And what that means is the only ways we're going to have to reduce our fire susceptibility is by working on the fuel, cutting it down, making fire breaks, maybe even burning areas to, you know, controlled burns, spraying maybe just to disrupt the continuity of these grasslands. Otherwise, we've got to convert to something that just won't burn. He said in Makaha last summer, the only things that didn't burn were the golf courses.
interesting,
right? So he says, you know what? He's a little sheepish about the actions we can take, what it really will take to mitigate our fire risk. It's to plant trees. He says it's got a lot of other benefits as well.
sequestering carbon, locking them up in trees and soils has multiple benefits. And if you go back to the CCC days in the 30s, I mean, we were planting millions of trees every year. There was this big overpopulation of goats that pretty much denuded the coal owls, and they were afraid we were going to lose all of our topsoil. The need was recognized by the public and by the government, and these projects were funded. And that, a lot of that obviously was coming from the federal government.
Oh, it was.
But, I mean, they were literally planting millions of trees a year. It's within our capacity to do it. We've got this incredibly diverse and inspirational group of watershed partnerships and other folks that are doing this work. We have a lot of know-how across the state to tap into, and a lot of super dedicated people that are already devoting their lives to these things, yeah. But they're all struggling for funding.
Interesting how he sets up our situation here. We've got more danger ahead with the climate change situation, but we have the people in place here now in our state who already are working on it.
Well, it's interesting, too, because there are a number of things that tie together with this. You talked about watershed protection, and sometimes people don't make that connection in terms of forested land and watershed protection, but that's a very basic point in that whole cycle. And just as that greening up cycle, as lots of rain, things grow when those grasses dry, they become fuel. Again, a way longer term around that is further attention in terms of watershed protection and buildup on that side as well.
Exactly. It's you know, even our dear friend Chip Fletcher, the Mr. Climate Change, was astounded that the best idea he's seen coming around the bend is planting more trees. And even planting more any kind of plants.
All right. Go plant something. All right.
can do this.
We can. Noe Tanigawa, you know that she covers arts, cultures, ideas for us here at Hawaii Public Radio. You can find more on this story and more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Oahu Choral Society, announcing auditions for singers in all voice parts 5 to 9 p.m. Monday, August 12th at the University of Hawaii Music Department. Details and reservations at oahuchoral.org.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you about Japanese Baseball League legend and Hawaii hometown hero Wally Yonamine. During his 12-year career in the Japanese Major Leagues, the NPB, Yonamine won multiple awards and titles, including 3 batting championships, a Most Valuable Player award, and 4 Japanese League championship trophies, mostly during his play with the Yomiuri Giants. Following his retirement, he became the first foreigner to manage a Japanese baseball club, in this case his former team, the Chunichi Dragons. After his baseball career, he ran a successful pearl store, Wally Yonamine Pearls, with his wife Jane in the Tokyo neighborhood of Roppongi Hills. Yonamine was the first American to play baseball in Japan following World War II and is credited with revolutionizing batting techniques in the Japanese major leagues. Yonamine passed away in Honolulu in 2011, a few islands away from his birthplace of Oluwalu, Maui. No winner today on that one. Lots of baseball fans out there, though. That is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. The Trans-Pacific Yacht Race, better known as TransPAC, stretches over more than 2,000 miles from California to Hawaii. Dozens of yachts and their teams compete in the long-distance sailing race, which has been running every other year since 1906. This year marked the 50th running of Transpac, and 90 boats competed, ranging in size from 30 feet to 100 feet in length. For the first time in the race's history, one of those boats never made it to port. 2 days into the race, a ship called the OEX began taking on water in the middle of the night. Roy Disney owns the Piwacket, which responded to a distress call from the sinking OEX and rescued its crew. That prevented him from finishing the race, but he flew to Hawaii for the closing ceremony and talked about the rescue with HBR's Ryan Finnerty.
Roy, could you give us a sense for people who aren't sailors what goes into preparing for this race?
A lot. You're preparing people, you're preparing food, you're preparing the boat, you're preparing all the parts of the boat. You're preparing logistics for getting people to and from. You're preparing the return of the boat to California, in my case. It's a lot. And the irony of Transpac is that it's a long race, and you can't get to that buoy soon enough. But as soon as you pass that buoy, you're already thinking, how would I do the next one? That's the attraction. This would have been my 23rd Transpac, which is a record. Gary Weissman and I would have owned the record for most Transpacs, and that's consecutively, too. So that's a lot.
What are some of the specific concerns, maybe with particular attention towards crew safety?
It's always a concern. The reality is you're on your own when you leave the dock, and everybody understands that the ocean is always bigger than you are, so you respect that. And the other understanding is that there may not be any help. In this case, we were lucky because we happened to be right behind the boat that sank, which is a good thing. But that may not always happen. So you have to be prepared. In fact, Transpac will not let you go on this race unless you prove to them that you're capable.
Could you give us a little bit of an overview how it played out that night when you got the distress call and what happened to that crew?
Okay, so we spent the first day drifting in very light winds. We only traveled about 110 miles in 24 hours, which is awful. But then we finally got out into the offshore wind around 6, 7 o'clock, and we were moving really good. Finally, everybody was excited to have the sails up doing 15, 16 knots. And I was just starting to wake up for my watch. One of my friends was putting his foul weather gear on down below. Now, we leave the radio on, but at a low volume because guys are sleeping. And just happened to hear the pitch of the voice. You can always tell when somebody's under duress. And the pitch of the voice was just high and fast. And then I heard the words OEX, which I knew to be a competitor of ours, direct competitor. And I asked my friend, Benny, I said, did you hear what I just heard? And he said, yeah, that was OEX. And I said, where are they? And when the sun went down, they were 30 miles south of us. So my immediate thought was, we can't help. We're too far away. But then we woke up our navigator, and sure enough, they were 2 miles in front of us. So we just altered course slightly and sailed down to them and then sort of played it as it laid out. Took our sails down, turned the motor on. They launched their life rafts as soon as they saw us. This is 2:30 in the morning, by the way, 2:40. And you're still on LA time at that point. So, and they used the life rafts to transfer themselves from their sinking boat onto our boat. You wouldn't have wanted to put the two boats together. That's dangerous. And everything worked out well.
What condition was OEX in when you arrived
on
the scene?
They left their mainsail up, which is a black sail. There were no lights on board, so it was kind of looking like a ghost ship to me. And my understanding was there was about a foot left to the deck level before it was sinking. But it looked like it was going to go down. And they were, believe me, ecstatic to get off that boat. I credit them with a lot of things. They didn't panic. They did all the things in all the right order. And frankly, climbing into a life raft at 2:33 in the morning in rough seas 300 miles offshore is pretty courageous. It's a leap of faith. You don't know what's going to happen after you get in that life raft because you're giving up the one thing that you're supposed to stay on till the bitter end, the boat. Stay with the boat. The guys were quiet. And I suspect because it's a traumatic event, I suspect there was some trauma. And not a lot of guys did a lot of talking after they got on the boat. We made sure that they were downstairs and they were warm because they'd been sitting in water for some time. And got them food and made sure that their blood sugar got back to normal. And it was they were in shock, no question.
And are you able to do all the ships, you're able to see their each position using GPS, or how did you know where they were?
So we use a tracker device called Yellow Brick, but it's delayed by 4 hours. But we can sort of interpolate where boats are based on that. And there's also a thing called AIS, Automated a Ship Identification System. And within a 25-mile circle, we can see any boat around us that has AIS on. So we knew right away.
Is there any hesitation, it being a race, about stopping to help?
None whatsoever. In fact, rule number one of the racing rules of racing is save lives. Save your fellow crewmen. Save your fellow boats.
Did they have any idea that you were on your way, or was that a surprise to them when you showed up?
No, the only thing they had an idea of was that they were sinking, and they made a general radio call and hoping somebody would answer. But no, they didn't know where we were.
Do we have any idea what happened, what caused the boat to start taking on water?
Not specifically. In talking to Chuck Clay, who was driving the boat, he said he was driving normally and there was a loud bang and then he had no steering left. So they didn't, obviously at night you can't see anything in the water, and apparently there is stuff in the water. And it's a miracle we don't hit it. Of course, we had this tsunami in Japan, and I think 4 years ago was the worst it has ever been. But there is, of course, in the Great Pacific High, the Great Gyre, a ton of stuff. And it floats around, and sometimes it breaks loose of the circulation and floats south to us. My first year I did it, we might have seen one piece of rope or netting or a bag every other day. And now we see one an hour. And that's when we can see them in the daylight. Who knows what we're sailing by at night? So,
what kind of precautions can you take against that kind of marine debris?
Just hope that your bills are paid and you've got good luck and your insurance is paid up. No, there's nothing really. I mean, I've done, like I said, a lot of transpacs, and we've woken up in the morning and had plastic bags wrapped around the keel, big ropes that we've had to stop and back down and get off the boat. So it's not like it hasn't happened before. But some pieces are bigger than others. For instance, it was Maserati that broke off their port bow by hitting something that they claimed was a meter and a half high in the water. God knows what that was. But they're going 25, 26 knots, and even if they saw it in time, I don't know what they could have done to avoid it, but that must have been an impact. So yeah, there's all sorts of stuff. But 4 years ago, there were docks, boats, containers, logs. You know, a third of Japan was in the water. But we think they hit something, but that's just my conjecture. And what happened was the bottom of the rudder, which goes through the hull, had broken loose and was now swaying back and forth, cutting an even bigger hole in the bottom of the boat. They tried to stop it by putting buckets on top of the hole, but the one guy said he sat on the bucket and it shot him, 10 feet in the air. So there was no stopping the water at that point.
You mentioned this was the 50th running of the Transpac, and this is the first incident of this kind that's ever happened. What do you attribute to that pretty sterling safety record?
Well, again, the fact that sailors have to prove that they're capable of doing this event, and Transpac as a board vets all the boats. And there's an extensive inspection process to make sure that all the pieces are in place. There's safety at sea seminars that train sailors how to deal with these situations, because the reality is you are on your own. And that's a general understanding amongst all sailors who go offshore. You have to be responsible for yourself and your welfare. In my case, I had three guys who had done several round the world Volvo Ocean races. That's not a bad thing, but not everybody has that or can have access to those kinds of people. But the reality is equally the same for everybody.
Right before we started talking, you had a brief encounter with the spouse of one of the men that you helped save. What was that like?
She doesn't have the words. It's very emotional. It's a very emotional thing. And I could tell that her husband is still thinking about it. In fact, he admitted that. He still thinks about it. It's a very traumatic thing. I can't even imagine, seeing the thing that you love, that you live for, disappear underneath your feet. It's pretty profound.
Do you think those guys will get back out on the water?
Absolutely. It's in your blood. It's in your blood. They can't say thank you enough, and I understand that. But to me and to us, first of all, it happened very fast. From the 15 minutes from when we got the call to when we arrived on site, which is pretty fast. But there's no talking or discussing, should we, shouldn't we. That's not a choice. We just did what we had to do, and I am 100% positive, had the roles been reversed, they would have done exactly the same thing. It's not a debate, it's what you do.
HPR's Ryan Finnerty talking a story with Roy Disney about rescue, trauma, survival, and helping out. Disney's the owner of the yacht Piwacket, which helped rescue 9 men from a sinking ship during the Transpac long-distance sailing race this year. We'll have links to photos and more information at hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, we know what President Trump thinks about Baltimore, but how do the people of Baltimore see themselves? We'll have a roundtable of citizens from Charm City. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2, following the world.
That's the program for today. Up tomorrow, Opala Time. We talk about trash and how we deal with it across the islands. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. Leave us a comment. Number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. If you missed any of the show, want a past one, go to the Conversation page with links to more information under HPR News and Talk at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Bill Dorman. Catherine's back tomorrow, and you can join us for more of The Conversation.